Hello and welcome to another edition of Podcasts from the Edge. My attempts to understand why the simple things going on around me always turn out to be more complex than they seem. I'm Peter Bruce and I make this podcast for the Financial Mail, and you can also find it on the Spotify and Apple podcast platforms. I hope you found them and are listening and are enjoying what you hear. This edition sees the return of a recent guest, an important guy because in my experience there's so few of him around. He's an economic historian. He doesn't track current policy much, but he can tell you what happened the last time something like it was attempted. So welcome back, Keith Breckenridge, a professor in the Wits Institute for Social and Economic Research and one of the top economic historians in the country. Keith emailed me last week to draw my attention to what seemed like an extraordinary book that tries to explain how vast corruption in China and that country's extraordinary economic growth might be explained. We know a lot about corruption in South Africa, and conventional wisdom would tell us that corruption prevents growth or somehow damages it. So how do you explain China? In her book, China's Gilded Age, The Paradox of Economic Boom and Vast Corruption, University of Michigan politics professor Yuanyuan Ang does something just great. She breaks down corruption into a series of types of species, most of which we might recognize, but one of which may actually be useful, a little bit perhaps like cartels were once thought to be. Keith, thanks for the tip-off and thanks for joining me. What does Ang's book tell us that we don't already know about corruption?
Oh, thank you, Peter. Thanks very much for the introduction and thanks everybody for joining us. I mean, there are many things. The first is this point that you just made about breaking corruption up into these four different types. The ones we're familiar with are what she would call grand larceny or grand theft. There's petty theft. So that would be the post office official helping themselves to your, not that that ever happens, helping themselves to the contents of your mail. And then there is what she calls speed up money. And that's when you're paying an official to do their job, the job they're supposed to be doing, but which for whatever reason they do very slowly. We're also, I think, familiar with that in South Africa. And then the final one is what she calls access money. And these are the big payments that are typical in actually most societies. Almost all political orders find a way for the people who hold political power to extract payments as part of the decision-making process. And that's the heart of this book. She shows how access money is the form of corruption in China that's really – all the other forms have been policed away over the last 20 years – and it's access money that's remained in place. The book is also partly about the dangers of the Xi campaigns against access money. So she's also warning that there's a new, if you like, temperature, a new political mood in China in the context of a really pervasive and ongoing campaigns against these kinds of access payments. So that breaking up of corruption into four separate types. What happens is you end up with a different kind of worldview of corruption because access payments are actually very common, as the Greensill story in Britain shows us, and they're common in the United States, especially where people cycle in and out of government between the lobbying agencies and the big banks. That's really been key to how the allocation of resources is actually made in those societies.
How would it work in China, though? I mean, so I can understand the revolving door in the States and Greensill in the UK has been very embarrassing, I presume, for people like former Prime Minister, all of whom seem to pay this man who started the bank. He's Australian, I think. Vast amounts of money, some of which bounced back, I suppose, to the Tory party, so that he could get access to the things that he needed. But what does the Chinese version of that look like, and what might our version of that look like?
Well, the version that she's looking at is how this plays out in local government. And these local governments are, in fact, of course, really enormous governments. They're, the local government in China, the province is, you know, the size of a large OECD state. So she's looking at how the political party figures who control provinces and cities, large cities of sort of 10 million people, are able to extract investments from payments from property developers. That's the core of the work that she's interested in.
But one of the things that she concludes is that this has helped China grow.
Yes, absolutely. So that's the core of the mystery. I mean, the fact that China's grown.
That's the paradox.
You know, 10% per annum, you know, over the last 30 years is the fundamental, it's really the big economic problem that the rest of the world is trying to make sense of. And it's the same problem that she's interested in. She wants to try and understand why that's happened. And she's interested to have a go at or disagree with the kind of, the, what we could call the kind of establishment argument. So the establishment argument really is that they have had this distinctively capable Confucian bureaucracy. So which is really driven by meritocracy. They had sort of, you know, 1500 years ago, an examination-based state. And so the idea is everybody in China has done a PhD in operations research, and they are all kind of, you know, academically much cleverer than everybody else. And the core of her argument is she doesn't say that it's not important, but what she's arguing instead is that there is a set of incentives, and those incentives are structured in a way that really, really drives growth in a way that's completely different in other places. So the model in South Africa is much more, it's about redistribution, but it has almost no growth benefits.
We have a sort of dysfunctional corruption rather than...
Yeah, ours is mostly, it's actually, I would say, retards growth. It has long-term damaging effects on companies. And what she shows is that it's partly these access payments, but a much bigger part of this is how the whole bureaucracy in China is broken down into these local government units that are actually competing with each other. The provinces compete and the towns compete within the provinces. And then what happens is that the officials, they get about a quarter of their salary in a fixed payment. And three quarters of it is in what we would call goodies. These are housing benefits, a car, education allowance, all sorts of things. And those are all funded through indirect taxes that are levied at the local government level. So you have a kind of alliance between the rent seekers and the officials in driving the development of businesses at the local level. And that's been the kind of a rocket fuel of the Chinese economy. And it's the really important insight in this book is that she finds this isn't the normal view of bureaucracy at all. This is a bureaucracy that's very heavily motivated by what we call the success of local businesses. Everything, you know, unlike we have this GEPF, this sort of big cloud in the sky that pays people's pensions regardless of what happens in their work. In the case of the Chinese bureaucracy, if people fail, they lose everything. You know, if the town stops basically working, the officials collapse. The whole project of earning their salaries falls to pieces.
She's interesting. I mean, I read a review that you sent me from the book's published, I think, by the London School of Economics. And I read a review, and the review describing what she's doing. Talks about corruption being a sort of a drug, different drugs having different effects on the body. She talks about access money as like a sort of a steroid or a performance enhancing drug in sport. It facilitates growth by allowing large corporations to win public contracts, deregulate markets, etc. Access money is access to the decision makers, and these in turn grant access to more business opportunities. This type of corruption enhances economic growth by increasing investments, but taxes the social body with rising inequality. Just come back to South Africa for a moment. I mean, what can we usefully learn from this book?
The two, you know, she's very careful to say that there isn't a model that can be kind of, you know, replicated. We can't go to China and learn what they've done and say that it would apply in other places. But the thing that she does stress is that people need to be, they need to be brave enough to innovate around the central model of what people, how people think economies should function. So that's the core. We should be looking at what we've got, and we should be thinking about designing, in particular, a set of incentives that will produce better outcomes. The core of the argument is this, and it is an accident. They fell onto these incentives because they had no money. You know, the Chinese Communist Party in 1985, it had no resources, so it couldn't pay salaries. It couldn't offer people, you know, significant pensions. It had to offer kind of, if you like, a revenue sharing a model to these local officials, and literally hold out the promise to them that if they did the work properly, that they would earn more in the future. So there's a kind of deferment built into the model.
That's okay. Come back to South Africa. Come to my hometown. I grew up in Mthatha. Mthatha is not the quaint little village that it used to be, but it could, in a way, if it was run properly, by incentivized people, incentivized by whatever, be quite a wealthy town. The population has grown from 12,000 or so to, you know, probably more than a million, or close to a million. And there's a lot of money spent in Mthatha that isn't captured. I mean, it's all cash. It's a cash economy. What is it about the way we are structured that prevents us from, not from copying the Chinese, but prevents us from, you know, taking what we've got and giving it that steroid injection?
So, I'm wary of making suggestions about what we should do, but so let me just reconstruct what she says has happened, and then we can think about how it might work here. So the core of her argument is that local government officials are paid out of local revenues, and that includes in particular VAT. So VAT is a local government tax. It doesn't go to Pretoria. It would go, the VAT that Mthatha raised would become the kind of main revenue source in the municipality. And, you know, that then creates this kind of driver of the whole bureaucracy working to try and ensure that businesses are attracted to the town and that the businesses do well. And that ultimately that they survive and the infrastructure works to make these businesses stronger. I would say that's some version of that is what we need. We have to have a situation where officials basically they're rewarded for the work. They're paid for getting their jobs done, and we can't keep paying people salaries when the institutions that they're supposed to be looking after are falling to pieces, and essentially the people who pay the price for that are usually the workers, the people who don't have access to the GEPF, the government employees pension fund, because the pension fund acts as a kind of a safety net for all the higher level officials in South Africa, and that's what she says she's describing in China does not exist. You know, these Chinese officials basically are dependent on the prosperity, the profitability of their particular government enterprise. And so they work very hard to make it function. I would be careful about saying, let's try and replicate everything she's described in this book. But I do think we can step away from it and ask ourselves, what are we incentivizing people to do in South Africa? And by and large, the big incentives are all in, there are inequity agreements that are handed out as part of BEE deals. I think that's how we have to be, you know, honest. That's where the real goodies lie in our economy.
When you say that, you mean black empowerment deals or?
Typically, the deals are outside of the performance of the state. Let's put it like that. So that the rewards are all for things that you can get that have nothing to do really with your function in the bureaucracy. You might become a director in one of the companies that you're supposed to be regulating. That's a very common model all over in the capitalist world. But what she's describing is something much closer to a kind of a bonus system that actually rewards officials for doing their job properly.
Before we went on air, we were talking about party financing. the Chinese Communist Party, if you compare it, say, with the ANC here, it doesn't, does it not fund its, I don't know how the Chinese system works at all. I mean, do all Chinese, is it able simply to tax, is there a party tax on the whole country, or how do, because left-wing parties like the Chinese Communist Party or the ANC almost have to be corrupted or corruptible or get corrupt money, because their constituents don't, or their members don't have money to pay membership fees. So they have to invent ways to get it.
You know, this is a difficult problem. This is not something she describes in this book, and it's not something I've read up much about. I think we, you know, you can see from some distance that the party is enormously wealthy now, and has, you know, it has a, it is literally a parallel state with its own salary body and its own committees and commissions making decisions about, you know, who gets promoted and who gets fired and driven out of the party. It's definitely not functioning at all like the conventional left social democratic or communist parties where, you know, you're required to find a fairy godfather who's going to look after the party and get his you know, whatever.
I think I read it somewhere that the central committee of the party had over 100 billionaires, dollar billionaires on it. Probably, and that probably was an underestimation. What are the characteristics? I mean, so she takes to develop this sort of methodology of measuring or differentiating between kinds of corruption. She looks at a whole lot of countries, doesn't she?
Yeah, she does.
And was there anything in the other countries that you saw that sort of kind of rang true, or you thought, oh, that's interesting? And you know, I mean, how does I don't know whether Brazil was one of them. But there must be a tendency when we're talking about access money corruption, it must be for big economies. I mean, things happen in economies like the US and China and Brazil and India that are just impossible in smaller countries with smaller markets and smaller populations and smaller land masses. Are there characteristics of the Chinese model? Did she find them anywhere else?
So she finds access money just about everywhere. Okay. You know, and it takes many different forms. So the way she asks these questions, she doesn't. She gives people a vignette. She says, you know, what are these circumstances common in the place in which you work? So do you need to employ somebody who was previously in the regulator as a way of kind of building your relationship with the state? So you can ask that as a vignette, and you'll get a yes answer on, and no, she doesn't say yes, no. She asks for how common is this on a scale of 1 to 5? And so what she ends up with is very high frequencies for that kind of access payment. So that would be, you know, you either, you're Goldman Sachs and you want to make sure that you get the regulation you want. So the best way of doing that is to hire people who bring people into Goldman Sachs who had been previously working in the New York branch of the Federal Reserve. Or it's clear this happens in just about all modern economies. So people can go from, they can take their insider regulator's information and kind of leverage that into a really well-paid position in one of the companies. And that's what Cameron did in the Greensill case. Is he took his, you know, his prestige and insider contacts in the British state, and he put them into equity in Greensill, imagining he was going to be enormously wealthy, I imagine.
But I wonder, Keith, whether anything even remotely like that is possible here, you know, because what we have, instead of passing in and out of government, either as a politician or an official, what happens is that with every change of presidency here in the ANC, everybody's cleared out and almost banished. You know, nobody gets back in. You can see some politicians, people like Trevor Manuel, become chairman of Mutual, and one or two other people will get, you know, directorships. Tito Mboweni, when he was finished at the bank, sat on a couple of boards. But there's nothing really systematic about it. I mean, when you are out of politics, you are reckoned to have eaten your share, I suppose, or eat of power or money or whatever, and you're gone, you know. And we've managed in a way to cock up corruption completely, you know. We're with a little bit more thought and guile, it might have been more useful to us.
Yeah, I think we do need to figure out a way to decentralize the relationship between firms and politicians. And we keep trying to centralize things, thinking that will help us. And what it's doing is it's kind of breaking the way in which the state functions at the local government level. So, and South Africans have this kind of anathema around corruption. And one of the reasons for that is because we have these enormous corporations in which, you know, when Rhodes first set up the British South Africa Company, he pretty much went around the Cape trying to figure out who the figures were that he needed to buy off. And he offered them equity in the company. And, you know, they kept quiet about what he was up to north of the Limpopo. And I think there is that model that, you know, that it's the deal at the very top that ultimately gets to make the decisions about how the economy is going to function. And the problem with that is that we've lost mechanisms for keeping all the other people actually busy properly and getting them to do their work. So, and I think this can be done. I don't think it has to be done as a brown paper bag full of cash.
Yeah.
I think you can offer people essentially incentives and performance incentives so that they get something out of doing their jobs properly.
Well, you know, as the review that I read was saying, and I want to come back to China today, the review says corruption in China's case is handled through a profit sharing arrangement. The arrangement turns the bureaucracy into sort of stationary bandits, is the term used, rather than roving bandits. Because of this, the Chinese bureaucracy is invested in development, and they have a stake in attracting investment by not scaring off business opportunities. And if you stop that, this is we're just venturing, just playing with the thought. Xi Jinping is going on a strong anti-corruption drive. He kills you. You get shot. You know, or if you're caught acting corruptly in China now, what is the likely effect of that going to be? Or does he mean it, or does he understand what he's sitting on?
I don't think there's any question he means it. And that, one of the things she shows is how extensive, you know, she's talking about 50,000 people who've been already successfully prosecuted. I mean, one of the things that's really striking about the Chinese political order is how quick these you know, prosecutions are. So if you're charged with corruption, the whole process is over. 3 months later, you're in prison. It doesn't take any time at all. There's no real, because the legal, it's not that they don't have a legal system, but it's a legal system geared towards basically supporting them and bolstering the authority of the state. And Ayn is very worried about what this will mean in the long run. But she's also making an argument. She's comparing, this is this comparison between what she calls the Gilded Age and the Progressive Era. So she's comparing, if you like, the period of the younger J.P. Morgan, the son, or the, you know, the Rockefellers, the Carnegies, when you really had robber baron capitalism in the United States. So it's really after the Civil War, 1865, and it begins to unravel in 1895 when the reformers, the progressives, begin to take, and that was usually associated with Teddy Roosevelt, when the American state begins to get a grip on these what people call trusts. So she's implying that the Chinese economy is going through a moment of reform like that, and that it may well be good for them. It may be a good thing that they can get, you know, essentially police these kind of access payments that have otherwise been common. But she's also worried about how you get selected for prosecution. And she shows that the key determinant of whether you get prosecuted or not is whether your protector, so all Chinese, significant political figures have a patron higher up the food chain. And what determines whether you get convicted of corruption or not is whether your patron has fallen from grace at the top, at the Politburo or above the Politburo. And that cascades down through the Communist Party, taking out these local government figures who've been, successful. And she's obviously very worried about what that will do in the long run to decision-making processes in China. But you could see that it's an interesting, she's suggesting it could go either way. You could have a kind of progressive era moment. This is, probably the most popular figure in the United States is Franklin Delano Roosevelt in that progressive period in which somebody, literally manages to use clean government, but also kind of drive towards equality, towards redistribution to make the system actually work better for ordinary people.
Is it just a fact of life, Keith, of economic life, that the growth of middle classes or the growth of wealth is messy and untidy and unsightly and corrupt in general around the world? I mean, we've seen China come from nothing, to what it is today. And as you talk about the robber barons in the U.S. in the late 1800s, I mean, is this what happens when you start expanding or thinking big? We now have cottoned on in South Africa to the possibility that infrastructure and big infrastructure spend, not happening, but, in theory, there are fortunes to be made out there if they spend all the money that they say they're going to make, that they say they're going to spend. Is it just something you just basically have to put up with? Is that some of this wealth creation is going to be corrupt?
Well, I don't think there's any question that it's definitely true that it's messy and morally, the best you could say is it's morally dubious. So there have been many, many examples of this where elites, have managed to take the South Sea bubble, for example, kind of speculative moments and turn them into long-term prosperity for large numbers of people. The best example is probably the way the Korean War and the Vietnam War drove prosperity in California. The three big wars, the Second World War, the Korean War, and the Vietnam War really made California into this kind of boom economy. That we don't have anything like that. And one of the problems is, unlike the Chinese, we are very happy and contented in many respects. We've got an unhappy, all of our dangers are in the past. We believe that's the thing we really have to be focused on fixing is the history. And we don't have a feeling about any real urgency that we must be careful about, Mozambique or in Angola or somebody else. So, and I think that's the in all these other cases, the some significant outside threat has been the thing that's kept the kind of driver of investment and prosperity. It's by themselves, I don't think we can bear any good examples of kind of natural middle class prosperity developing
What we need to do is encourage someone to invade us.
We need a much stronger sense of urgency and danger, I'm afraid.
I'm going to leave it there, and thanks, Keith Breckenridge, for joining me here again and for all your effort and for your knowledge. The book we've been talking about is called China's Gilded Age, The Paradox of Economic Boom and Vast Corruption by Yanyan Ang and published by the London School of Economics. I hope we'll be hearing from Prof. Breckenridge more often. I love economic history, and the older I get, the less interested I find I am in the future and the more I want to know about the world I was born into. In fact, what were South African lives like during the Korean War when I was born? That's a question for another day. Thanks so much for listening. And you'll be hearing from me again soon. Bye.